It's not a matter of merely canceling shows or movies either. Artists who cross the woke mob find themselves targeted for destruction. In July 2018, Scarlett Johansson dropped out of production on a movie titled Rub and Tug about a transgender man. The radical left suggested that only a transgender man could play a transgender man. A biological woman who did not identify as a man could not. Now, this is one of the most absurd contentions in human history. Actors literally act like other people. And verisimilitude shouldn't have been an issue here. A biological human female was playing a biological human female who believes she is male. Yet the woke community decided it was better that the film, starring one of Hollywood's biggest stars, be canceled outright rather than starring a non-transgender person. Johansson duly performed her penance. I am thankful that this casting debate has sparked a larger conversation about diversity and representation in film. This illogical proposition creates some awkward moments. When Ellen Page announced that she was a transgender man, the series in which she stars, Umbrella Academy, announced it would be fine for Elliot Page, a transgender man, to continue to play a non-transgender woman. This puritanism regarding woke standards represents a serious career threat to comedians who make their money off willingness to mock hard and fast rules. Hilariously, this has led to the specter of top comics tearing into the woke. After Sarah Silverman, a radical leftist, revealed that she had lost a film role thanks to a blackface sketch from 2007, again, the sketch was about racism faced by Black Americans, she tore into cancel culture. Without a path to redemption, when you take someone, you found a tweet they wrote 7 years ago or a thing that they said, and you expose it and you say, this person should be no more, banish them forever. Do we want people to be changed? Or do we want them to stay the same, to freeze in a moment we found on the internet from 12 years ago? Dave Chappelle has slammed cancel culture, calling it celebrity hunting season. Bill Burr ranted on Saturday Night Live. You know, how stupid is that canceled thing? They're literally running out of people to cancel. They're going after dead people now. Rowan Atkinson recently and correctly compared the cancel culture to the digital equivalent of the medieval mob roaming the streets looking for someone to burn. He added, it becomes a case of either you're with us or against us. And if you're against us, you deserve to be canceled. How Hollywood got renormalized. All of this raises a serious question. If woke culture quashes compelling entertainment, wrecks comedy, and generally makes entertainment worse, why cave to it? Why not simply make entertainment for the broadest possible swath of Americans? The answer lies once again in renormalization. All it takes to renormalize an institution is a solid minority of intransigent, inflexible people. Catering to that base, while preying on the innate compliance of the majority, can lead to a complete reorientation. That's precisely what happened in Hollywood. Where Hollywood used to broadcast, emphasis on broad, searching for the biggest possible audience, they now narrowcast in order to appease the inflexible leftist coalition. Practically, this means catering to critics, who are near universal in their reflection of woke priorities. It also means super serving intransigent subsets of the audience and counting on the rest of the audience to go along. Hollywood critics are monolithically adherents to authoritarian leftism. This authoritarian leftism has infused film criticism to an extraordinary extent. Films, if perceived as political, are no longer judged broadly on their merits. Instead, they're judged on checking woke boxes. Rotten Tomatoes, the one-stop shop for movie criticism, demonstrates a clear bias in favor of leftist films. For critics, Rotten Tomatoes' aggregation of opinion also exacerbates confirmation bias. Critics don't want to stand out from the crowd. As Owen Gleiberman of Variety writes, the sting of the pressure to conform is omnipresent. When one Variety critic recently had the temerity to suggest that Carey Mulligan was miscast in the left-wing-oriented Promising Young Woman, Variety went so far as to tar its own critic as a crypto-misogynist and offer an apology for his review. The top-down censorship of the authoritarian left is in full swing among the critics. The goal isn't just silencing dissent, but forcing public confession and repentance. There's a reason critics are, all too often, wildly out of touch with movie audiences. It's not rare for audiences to reject a film based on its lack of quality, but for critics to praise it to the skies for political reasons. For example, Ghostbusters 2016, the female cast reboot of the original Bill Murray classic, met with tepid audience response, a 50% positive score among audiences on Rotten Tomatoes, and a brutal box office run that cost the studio $70 million. That's because the film happens to be a mediocre piece of annoying crap. But according to critics, the movie was important. And it was important because it supplanted male leads with female leads. Megan Garber of The Atlantic wrote, "For a moment, it seemed the future of women in Hollywood and the future of feminism itself would be riding on the shoulders of Paul Feig, Ivan Reitman, Melissa McCarthy, and some CGI'd ghosts." And surprise, Garber found the movie to be pretty great, balancing ghosts and guns and gags and girl power. When critics come into conflict with audiences, there can be only one explanation. Americans are a bunch of bigots. So naturally, Ghostbusters' failure became evidence that Americans simply couldn't handle powerful females. And the film's failure was laid at the feet of these fans, who were merely frustrated man babies incapable of expressing a thought about a mediocre film. This phenomenon has been invoked over and over again to explain just why critics like movies the public often doesn't. If fans think that Star Wars The Last Jedi was an incoherent mishmash of bad plotting, destruction of beloved and iconic characters, addition of new and boring characters with a side plot of animal rights silliness, that's not because maybe they're right. It's because they are toxic fans. If, in particular, Star Wars fans found Rose, Kelly Marie Tran, to be an absolutely superfluous and soporific character, she was. That was because they were racist and sexist. The critics spoke and loved The Last Jedi, 90% fresh. The audience spoke and hated it, 42% fresh. Obviously, the audience was wrong. As Matt Miller of Esquire put it, Star Wars fans have tragically become synonymous with hate, bigotry, and pervasive assholishness in 2018. The Last Jedi inspired the worst impulses of a far-right movement that's taking hold of the internet and extending its influence into the real world. Toxic fans can be used as a constant excuse for the fact that critics are out of touch with the unwashed masses. Meanwhile, critics can be as toxic as they like with reference to work they perceive as insufficiently woke. Dave Chappelle's Sticks and Stones comedy special took on cancel culture and woke scolding, so critics excoriated it, giving it a 35% fresh score, complaining that Chappelle had become a man who wants it all, money, fame, influence, without much having to answer to anyone. When Chappelle reverted to rants about the nature of systemic American racism, the critics reverted to type. Can a comedy set win a Pulitzer? Theater at its most powerful. Not funny, but the comedian was in top form. Chappelle, it should be noted, survived in large measure because his entire shtick had been built around opposition to cancel culture. When Hillbilly Elegy premiered, the critics savaged it, 27% fresh, not primarily because of its movie making, but because between 2016 and 2020, it became unwoke to take seriously impoverished white protagonists or to champion the power of individual decision making. The movie review for The Atlantic, which deemed the film one of the worst movies of the year, found it worthy of note that the original book, which sold several million copies, often appears uninterested in interrogating deeper systemic issues. Audiences, by the way, loved the film. The audience rating was 86% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. Critics help kill entertainment projects they oppose politically. But most Americans don't sit around waiting for takes from the critics. The biggest factor cutting in favor of the woking of Hollywood, ironically enough, is the fragmentation of the market itself. For decades, the rule in Hollywood was to try to cater to the largest available audience, to broadcast. The biggest tentpole movies, think of the Marvel Universe, still do. But as the distribution mechanisms for entertainment fracture, it becomes more plausible to narrowcast toward particular audiences or to cater to the most intransigent audiences. Narrowcasting automatically breeds renormalization. Hollywood relies on conservative or apolitical Americans to ignore being offended and super serves those most likely to raise a stink or to consume products enthusiastically based on ideology. That's why Netflix has categories like Black Lives Matter Collection alongside drama and announced just before launching the Black Lives Matter genre, to be silent is to be complicit. The industry is no longer about producing blockbuster films geared toward drawing massive audiences. It's about pleasing the loudest, cudgeling everyone else, and hoping nobody will tune out. Most of the time, that hope is justified. After all, it's not as though there are tons of conservative-friendly alternatives out there. Even if you're offended by Netflix mirroring the woke dictates of BLM, you can't exactly switch over to Hulu or Amazon. Those companies put up their own propagandistic film categories designed to respond to America's racial reckoning and announce their own solidarity with Black Lives Matter. Renormalization of Hollywood, combined with closing the door to dissent, has created an entertainment monolith. How sports went woke, then went broke. The radicalization of entertainment is most obvious in the context of sports. Sports is the ultimate broadcasting entertainment. It is designed to hit all subgroups. It's pure competition, merit against merit, winners and losers. The narratives are generally apolitical and the plot lines perfectly simple. Sports is about taking on the competition, muscling through adversity, working with teammates. Sports unifies. Or at least it used to. Yes, politics played a crucial role in sports narratives. From Jackie Robinson breaking the color line in Major League Baseball to Muhammad Ali giving up his boxing career for refusing the Vietnam draft to the American Olympic hockey team defeating the Soviets. But once the game began, all exterior conflict was telescoped into the sport. Americans had strong rooting interests, often politically oriented, but the primary concern was the exhibition of skill on the field. Sports leagues worked to keep politics off the field or court entirely. When Denver Nuggets star Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf refused to stand for the national anthem in 1996, NBA Commissioner David Stern, a committed liberal, suspended him without pay. Raouf had violated a league policy requiring players and trainers to stand and line up in a dignified posture. When asked why he had remained apolitical in a contentious 1990 North Carolina Senate race, Michael Jordan explained, "Republicans buy sneakers too." Years later, he explained, "I wasn't a politician when I was playing my sport. I was focused on my craft." That sentiment was considered relatively uncontroversial. But then something changed. What changed was the renormalization along racial and political lines. ESPN, the top sports channel on the planet by a vast margin, began losing money hand over fist. The network cleared cash in two ways, through advertising, which was viewer reliant, and through carriage fees. Fully 75% of ESPN's money comes from cable and satellite subscribers. Cable and satellite companies pay ESPN to carry the network. ESPN takes that money and pays sports leagues in order to carry their content. Now, the vast majority of cable and satellite subscribers don't watch the vast majority of content on ESPN. So as people cut their cable and carriage fees dropped, and as other sports cable competitors got into the business and bid up the price of sports programming, ESPN found itself in a world of hurt. As sports journalist Clay Travis describes, its business model was under attack on two fronts. The cost of sports it rented and put on the air was surging just as its subscriber revenue was collapsing. In 2011, at the height of its business, ESPN had 100 million subscribers. By 2018, they'd lost 14 million subscribers. ESPN responded by putting more hot talk, more cheap to produce, guaranteed to create controversy hot takes on the air. As Travis points out, ESPN was elevating the talent that most fervently connected left-wing politics and sports. Jemele Hill, Max Kellerman, Sarah Spain, Bumani Jones, Michelle Beadle, Pablo Torre. The more left-wing your politics, the more you got on television. This was a reflection of both the political culture of the sports journalists themselves, who voted overwhelmingly Democrat, and the desire to super-serve a customer base that skewed disproportionately to the left. Demographic composition of fan bases varies widely based on the sport. NBA fans are disproportionately Black, for example. NHL fans are disproportionately white. And ESPN spends a disproportionate amount of time on sports viewed by minority audiences. As of 2012, according to Deadspin, SportsCenter spent 23.3% of its coverage on the NFL, 19.2% of its time on the NBA, and just 2.1% of its time on NASCAR. Yet according to a 2015 Harris poll, just 5% of Americans said that basketball was their favorite sport, compared to 6% who said auto racing. ESPN isn't skewing its coverage out of a weird sense of diversity, however. They're doing so because Black Americans watch more TV than white Americans and have historically spent more money per capita on visible goods like footwear, clothes, cars, and jewelry. And super-serving a disproportionately left-leaning population means catering to their political belief system, which just happens to reflect the values held by the higher-ups at ESPN. By catering to a small subsection of the population, a population that preferred its sports with a heavy dose of politics, the sports world renormalized itself around woke propositions. Sports leagues began catering to their political audiences, allowing politics to spill over onto the field. In 2014, a white police officer shot to death 18-year-old Michael Brown. Brown had assaulted the officer, attempted to steal his gun, fired it into the officer's car, and then charged the officer. Members of the media repeated the lie that Brown had surrendered to the officer with his hands raised. The slogan, "Hands up, don't shoot," became shorthand for the accusation that Brown had been murdered and for the broader proposition that police across America were systematically targeting Black Americans. And the sports world followed suit. Five players on the St. Louis Rams walked out during the pregame introductions with their hands raised in the "hands up, don't shoot" pose. The NFL quickly announced there would be no consequences, with NFL Vice President Brian McCarthy explaining, "We respect and understand the concerns of all individuals who have expressed views on this tragic situation." This wasn't out of a generalized respect for free speech values, however. It was about catering to wokeness. In 2016, after a Black Lives Matter supporter shot to death five police officers, the NFL rejected the Dallas Cowboys' request to wear a decal paying tribute to the victims. Over the course of the ensuing years, sports media's and leagues' embrace of on-field wokeness only increased. When Abdul Raouf protested the national anthem, it was utterly uncontroversial for David Stern to suspend him. When Colin Kaepernick, after being benched as starting quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers in favor of the immortal Blaine Gabbert, decided to kneel for the national anthem in protest at the police shooting of armed stabbing suspect Mario Woods, the media rushed to his defense. ESPN covered the millionaire Kaepernick as a hero, blanketing its network in worshipful praise for the benched QB, even as he declared that he would not stand up to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses Black people and people of color. The sports media then spent years propping him up as a civil rights icon. Eventually, the quarterback, who had once donned socks depicting police officers as pigs, was given millions of dollars by Nike, also attempting to super-serve leftist populations in order to sell shoes with the slogan, "Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything." In reality, Kaepernick sacrificed nothing. He had already been benched when he made his protest, would later avoid even the most basic preconditions for rejoining an NFL team, and has cleared millions of dollars in advertising. Nonetheless, Kaepernick is now treated as a hero in the sports world. In 2020, the NFL itself tried to leverage a team into signing him. For good measure, EA Sports named Kaepernick a starting caliber quarterback in its Madden NFL 21 game, despite the fact that Kaepernick hadn't played for years and wasn't very good the last time he did. The politicization of sports had dire ramifications for its audience numbers. Ratings, which were already in recession, went into steep decline. The most popular league in America, the NFL, saw ratings declines of nearly 10% during the 2017 regular season. ESPN saw such dramatic drop-off that ESPN president John Skipper, who had overseen the politicization of his network, admitted in late 2016, ESPN is far from immune from the political fever that has afflicted so much of the country over the past year. Internally, there's a feeling among many staffers, both liberal and conservative, that the company's perceived move leftward has had a stifling effect on discourse inside the company and has affected its public-facing product. Consumers have sensed that same leftward movement alienating some. Jemele Hill, an outspoken and censorious leftist, immediately shot back. "I would challenge those people who say they feel suppressed. Do you fear backlash, or do you fear right and wrong?" In 2018, Skipper was replaced by Jimmy Pitaro, chairman of its consumer products. He quickly admitted that ESPN had strayed from its core mission, uniting people around sports. Pitaro stated, "We have to understand we're here to serve sports fans, all sports fans." ESPN's internal research showed that all fans, liberal and conservative, didn't want to hear politics on ESPN. But the network and the leagues had already been renormalized. It was simply too late to pull out of the tailspin. By 2020, after the killing of George Floyd in police custody resulted in nationwide protests, virtually every sports league mandated wokeness. The NBA festooned its sidelines with the phrase "Black Lives Matter," a semantically overloaded phrase suggesting that America was irredeemably bigoted against Black Americans. That was, in and of itself, a rather shocking contention coming from an 80% Black league in which the average salary is $7.7 million per season. NBA players were told that they could emblazon woke slogans on the back of their jerseys, limited to "Black Lives Matter, say their names, vote, I can't breathe, justice, peace, equality, freedom, enough, power to the people, justice now, say her name, si se puede, liberation, see us, hear us, respect us, love us, listen, listen to us, stand up, ally, anti-racist, I am a man, speak up, how many more, group economics, education reform, and mentor." Thus, it became a common sight to see group economics blocking justice and I can't breathe throwing up an alley-oop to enough. How any of this had anything to do with sports was beyond reasonable explanation. The NBA's newfound commitment to political issues apparently stopped at calling America systemically racist. Houston Rockets general manager Daryl Morey was forced to apologize for tweeting "Free Hong Kong" as the Chinese government subjected that formerly free city to complete subservience. LeBron James, the most celebrated politically oriented athlete in America, called Morey misinformed. After all, LeBron, Nike, and the NBA make bank in the Chinese market. Major League Baseball opened its season with BLM stamped onto pitchers' mounds, universal kneeling before the national anthem, and Morgan Freeman voicing over, "Equality is not just a word, it's our right." The Tampa Bay Rays tweeted out, "Today is opening day, which means it's a great day to arrest the killers of Breonna Taylor." Taylor was accidentally killed during crossfire when police knocked on her apartment door to serve a no-knock warrant and were met by gunfire from her boyfriend inside. The NFL followed suit, with Roger Goodell admitting he was wrong by not overtly siding with Kaepernick in 2016, and the league painting social justice warrior slogans in the end zones during games. Phrases like "it takes all of us" and "end racism." Racism, as it turns out, was not ended, but at least the leagues had pleased their most ardent customers. Unfortunately for the leagues, there weren't that many of them anymore. The NFL's ratings dropped 10% in 2020. The NBA Finals declined 51% year on year. MLB's World Series was the least watched of all time. To be sure, not all of that decline had to do with politics. Sports viewership dropped across the board due to the pandemic. But the long downward trend of sports as a unifying factor in American life continued at record rates in 2020. Conclusion. When it comes to the politics of our entertainment, many Americans prefer to remain in the dark. Better not to think about politics being pushed than to turn off the TV. The result, large-scale emotional indoctrination into wokeism, courtesy of censorious authoritarian leftists in our new ruling class. Americans now float atop a tsunami of cultural leftism, from movies to television shows, from streaming platforms to sports games. And all of this has an impact. It removes an area of commonality and turns it into a cause for division. It turns the water cooler into a place of abrasive accusation rather than social fabric building. We are told by our new ruling class that worrying about culture is a sign of Puritanism. Meanwhile, they practice witch burning, insist that failure to abide by certain woke standards amounts to heresy, and use culture as a propaganda tool for their ideology and philosophy, renormalizing our entertainment in order to renormalize us. Our entertainment can reflect our values, but it can also shape them. Those in positions of power know this, and they revel in it. If entertainment is where Americans go to take a breath, and if the authoritarian left seeks to suck all the oxygen out of the room, we begin to suffocate. America is suffocating right now. And as our entertainment becomes more and more monolithic, less and less tolerant, more and more demanding, we become a less fun, less interesting, and less tolerant people. Chapter 7. The Fake News. Authoritarian leftism pushes revolutionary aggression. It calls for top-down censorship. It establishes a new moral standard whereby traditional morals are considered inherently immoral. If there is one institution that has more than any other engaged in the cramdowns of the authoritarian left, it is our establishment media. That media often cheers revolutionary aggression, participates in censorship of dissenting views, and seeks to have it cemented by powerful institutions, and promotes the notion that there is only one true moral side in American politics. In the summer of 2020, that truth became crystal clear. In response to the death of George Floyd while in police custody, massive protests involving millions of Americans broke out in cities across America. Never mind that even the circumstances surrounding Floyd's death were controversial. The police had been called to the scene by a shop owner after Floyd passed a counterfeit bill, was heavily drugged on fentanyl, resisted arrest, asked not to be placed in the police vehicle, and was in all likelihood suffering from excited delirium. Never mind that there was no evidence of racism in the actual Floyd incident itself. The impetus for the protests was rooted in a false narrative. The narrative that America was rooted in white supremacy, her institutions shot through with systemic racism, that Black Americans are at constant risk of being murdered by the police. Grand total number of Black Americans, out of some 37 million Black Americans shot dead by the police while unarmed in 2020, according to the Washington Post. 15. That narrative has been pushed by the media for years, in incidents ranging from the shooting of Michael Brown. The media pushed the idea that Brown had surrendered while shouting, "Hands up, don't shoot," an overt lie, to the shooting of Jacob Blake. The media portrayed Blake as unarmed, even though he was armed with a knife. The narrative didn't just result in protests. It resulted in violence, rioting, and looting. In Los Angeles, my hometown, the city shut down its iconic Rodeo Drive at 1 p.m. in the aftermath of looting. Melrose Avenue was systematically looted as well, and police cars were left to the tender mercies of rioters, who promptly set them on fire and spray-painted them with the slogan, ACAB, All Cops Are Bastards. Looters attempted to break into the Walgreens a few blocks south of our home. A few blocks north of us, the Foot Locker was looted. For days on end, in the middle of a pandemic, the authorities informed law-abiding citizens to lock themselves in their homes at 6 p.m. Santa Monica and Long Beach saw looting as well. The Los Angeles Times labeled the events largely peaceful. Similar scenes took place in Washington, D.C., Chicago, and New York, where days of rioting resulted in jarring scenes of flaming debris, stampedes, and looted storefronts, according to the New York Times. Police officers were injured and hundreds were arrested. The Times labeled the events largely peaceful. So did the Washington Post, which used the hilarious phraseology, mostly peaceful displays punctuated by scuffles with police. The media's desperate attempts to downplay the violence reached comical proportions, with reporter after reporter explaining that the protests were mostly peaceful. Ali Velshi of MSNBC stood in front of a burning building while intoning, "This was mostly a protest. It is not, generally speaking, unruly, but fires have been started." All of this came to its sadly hilarious culmination during riots in Kenosha, Wisconsin in August. A CNN reporter stood in front of a flaming background, the chyron reading, "Fiery but mostly peaceful protests after police shooting." Overall, the protests were mostly peaceful, only in the sense that many protests took place that didn't break into explicit violence. But riots and looting related to the BLM movement cost somewhere up to $2 billion, making them the most expensive riots and civil disorder in American history. The rioting hit some 140 cities. At least 14 Americans died in violence linked to the BLM unrest. More than 700 police officers were injured. At least 150 federal buildings were damaged. Many in the media went further than merely downplaying the violence. They fully excused it, cheered it, and justified it. They indulged their own revolutionary impulse. Now was a time to celebrate the revolutionary aggression inherent in their left-wing authoritarianism. Nicole Hannah-Jones of the New York Times explained, "Destroying property, which can be replaced, is not violence." She also cheered that some had termed the riots the 1619 riots in honor of her pseudo-history of the United States, the 1619 Project. "Nobody should be destroying property and that sort of thing, but I understand the anger," explained CNN's Don Lemon. "Our country was started, the Boston Tea Party, rioting. So do not get it twisted and think that, oh, this is something that has never happened before and this is so terrible and these savages and all of that. That's how this country was started. Fellow CNN anchor Chris Cuomo wondered, now, too many see the protests as the problem. No, the problem is what forced your fellow citizens to take to the streets, persistent, poisonous inequities and injustice. And please, show me where it says protesters are supposed to be polite and peaceful, because I can show you that outraged citizens are what made the country what she is. Harvard Associate Professor Elizabeth Hinton explained to Time magazine that rioting didn't really capture the essence of the events. Instead, the mob violence should have been termed an uprising, since it really captures the fact that the violence that emerges during these incidents isn't meaningless, that it is a political expression, and it is communicating a certain set of demands. USA Today printed an article tendentiously explaining riots, violence, looting. Words matter when talking about race and unrest, experts say. NPR printed the commentary of Mark Lamont Hill, who declared the riots acts of rebellion. And the media didn't stop with mere rhetorical flourishes. The overall narrative, that America was evil and that its police were systemically racist, led to practical efforts around the country to defund the police, cheered on by the media. Police officers, realizing that even a proper arrest, if effectuated by a white officer against a black suspect, could result in a media-led crusade against them and their departments, stopped proactively policing. As a result, thousands of Americans died in 2020 who simply wouldn't have died in 2019. As Heather McDonald observed in the Wall Street Journal, the year 2020 likely saw the largest percentage increase in homicides in American history. Based on preliminary estimates, at least 2,000 more Americans, most of them black, were killed in 2020 than in 2019. The media's desperate attempts to portray the Black Lives Matter movement as both legitimate and nonviolent led them to legitimize both untruth and violence. So when the media, quite properly, expressed outrage at the insanity of the January 6th Capitol invasion, Americans with an attention span longer than that of a guppy could see the hypocrisy and double standard a mile off. The media, it seems, is fine with political violence when it is directed at one side. When asked about their perfectly obvious shift from riot cheerleaders to riot chastisers, members of the media have reacted with pure outrage. To even compare the media's tolerance for BLM violence with their rage over January 6th meant that you were engaging in intellectual hypocrisy. Anyone who pointed out the double standard was hit with the charge of whataboutism, even though the entire basis for the double standard accusation was condemnation of violence across the board, condemnation in which the media had refused to engage itself. CNN's Lemon, for example, sputtered, I'm sick of people comparing. You can't compare what happened this summer to what happened at the Capitol. It's two different things. One was built on people, on racial justice, on criminal justice, right? On reform, on police not beating up or treating people of color differently than they do whites. Okay? That was not a lie. Those are facts. Go look at them. Lemon presented no such fact, but his opinion was good enough. After all, Lemon says that he has evolved as a journalist. Being a person, a black man, let's put it this way. Being an American who happens to be black, who happens to be gay, from the South, I have a certain lens that I view the world through, and that's not necessarily a bias. That's my experience. If I can't give my point of view and speak through the experience that I have had as a man of color who has lived on this earth for more than 50 years, who happens to have this platform, then when am I going to do it? I'd be derelict in my duty as a journalist and derelict in my duty as an American if I didn't speak to those issues with honesty. I think in this moment, journalists realize that we have to step up and we have to call out the lies and the BS, and it has nothing to do with objectivity. Lemon's statement encapsulates the media's breathtaking dishonesty. On the one hand, media members want to be free to express their politics in their journalism, which would cut directly against their purported objectivity. On the other hand, they want to maintain the patina of objectivity so as to maintain an unearned moral superiority over supposed partisan hacks on the other side. How can today's pseudo-journalism, or those who engage in journalisming, as I often term it, square the circle? They simply do what Lemon does. They suggest that their opinions are actually reflections of fact, that those who disagree are dishonest, and that objectivity doesn't require you to listen to other points of view or report on them. Journalists make themselves the story, and if you doubt them, you are anti-truth and anti-journalism. This skewing of journalism makes its purveyors, quite literally, fake news. They pretend to be news outlets, but are actually partisan activists. It would be difficult to find a single byline staffer at the New York Times who voted for Donald Trump. The same holds true at the Washington Post. Certainly, CNN, MSNBC, ABC News, CBS News, the LA Times, the Associated Press, none of them are hotbeds of Republican activity. According to a 2020 report in Business Insider, a survey of political donations from establishment media members found that 90% of their donated money went to Democrats. The survey included names from Fox and the New York Post. In 2013, a survey of journalists showed that just 7% identified as Republican. And by 2016, according to Politico, more than half of publishing employees worked in counties that Clinton won by 30 points or more, with just 27% of employees working in a red district. As Jack Schaefer and Tucker Dougherty acknowledged, on such subjects as abortion, gay rights, gun control, and environmental regulation, the Times' news reporting is a pretty good reflection of its region's dominant predisposition. Something akin to the Times' ethos thrives in most major national newsrooms found on the Clinton coasts. Our journalisming superiors don't just occupy a bubble. They occupy an isolation tank. Americans aren't blind. They distrust the media for a reason. Members of the media frequently blame Trump for endemic American mistrust of the Fourth Estate. They neglect the simple fact that Americans, particularly on the right, had justified trust issues long before Trump ever rose to prominence in politics. In 2013, for example, only about 52% of Americans trusted traditional media. Today, that number is 46%. Only 18% of Trump voters trust the media, compared with 57% of Biden voters. 6 in 10 Americans believe most news organizations are more concerned with supporting an ideology or political position than with informing the public. They happen to be correct. The only real question is why 4 in 10 Americans still believe in the veracity of a media that openly disdains and often seeks to target one entire side of the American political conversation. The rise and fall of media objectivity. From the outset, the American press has been a contentious lot, vying for supremacy and arguing passionately about right and wrong. The notion of a political objectivity in journalism would have seemed bizarre to the founding fathers. Thomas Jefferson employed journalist James Callender to muckrake on behalf of his favored causes and to undermine his enemies. For well over a century, newspapers openly identified with political parties. The era of yellow journalism was markedly free of concerns about objectivity. Only in the aftermath of World War I, with America's intelligentsia falling out of love with democracy itself, did the press begin to conceive of itself as objective, as guardian of a unique fact-finding process that could provide audiences with information beyond the realm of political debate. Leading the charge for objectivity was New Republic editor Walter Lippmann. Lippmann began life as a progressive activist, a political critic of the old individualism with its anarchistic laissez-faire, an advocate of great leaders acting through the collective will of the nation. Lippmann disdained Georgia crackers, poverty-stricken Negroes, the homeless and helpless of the great cities, and called for a governing class. He fretted about the ability of those who disagreed to peddle dissenting ideas. After all, they might be leading the public astray. Without protection against propaganda, without standards of evidence, without criteria of emphasis, the living substance of all popular decision is exposed to every prejudice and to infinite exploitation. The solution to all of this, Lippmann decided, was to curb free expression in favor of freedom from error, illusion, and misinterpretation. To this end, Lippmann proposed the notion of journalistic objectivity, explaining that editors were to act as a priestly caste. Newspapers were, said Lippmann, the Bible of democracy. To achieve this objectivity meant shifting the notion of what a journalist was. Instead of the sardonic, chain-smoking, flattened hat type working the streets, journalists were now transformed into scientific specialists, inculcated in the latest methods, protected from the heresies of the hoi polloi. Many in the press began to see themselves as a class apart. They viewed the freedom of the press guaranteed by the Constitution not as a guarantee that government refrain from infringing on Americans' right to engage in reporting and public debate generally, but as a specific protection for a specific and special group. People who have the title reporter next to their bylines, who work for certain prestigious publications. Lippmann's idea of regularizing a journalistic process wasn't bad, of course. Facts do exist, and we should use rational scientific methods to suss them out. Where Lippmann went wrong was in assuming that journalists wouldn't use their newfound sense of superiority to re-embrace their bias while presenting themselves as objective. And that's precisely what happened. Establishment institutions declare themselves objective and thus trustworthy. But in reality, sometimes partisan hacks can print truth, and self-appointed objective outlets can print lies. Objective journalists can lie through omission, favor allies through contextualization, focus on stories most flattering to their own political priors. Bias is simply inseparable from journalism. Some journalists do a better job than others at attempting to remove their own biases from the stories they cover. Virtually all fail, and over the past few years, they've begun to fail more and more dramatically. The establishment media's slavish sycophancy for Barack Obama, followed by their rabid, rancorous coverage of Donald Trump, followed again by their absurd ass-kissing for Joe Biden, has ripped the mask away. Lippmann insisted on at least a facade of nonpartisanship, despite his own elitism. Emphatically, the journalist ought not to be serving a cause, no matter how good. In his professional activity, it is no business of his to care whose ox is gored. As the observer of the signs of change, his value to society depends upon the prophetic discrimination with which he selects those signs. Our new ruling class journalists don't bother. These journalists argue that they are actually better journalists than the forebears who attempted to provide a variety of viewpoints in any controversy. Real journalists, they say, don't engage in false balance, meaning respect for a side other than their own. Real journalists, they say, bring their own experiences to bear. Real journalists, they say, are crusaders rather than passive observers. Real journalists are activists. Real objectivity is allegiance to refracting facts through the prism of leftism. The mask is off. In 2014, the Washington Post's Wesley Lowery found himself under arrest in a McDonald's during the Ferguson, Missouri riots in the aftermath of the shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown by Officer Darren Wilson. He claimed that he had been a victim of police brutality. The police claimed that Lowery had trespassed and refused orders to clear an area from the police. Lowry's perspective on endemic American racism was obvious. Later, he would write about Ferguson that reporting on the details of the shooting itself was irrelevant. Instead, the media should have focused on the broader narrative, contextualizing the riots and violence by referring to America's history of racial discrimination. Lowery was an opinionated fellow and routinely took to Twitter to disparage his critics. In fact, Lowry's Twitter habit eventually ended with Washington Post editor Marty Baron threatening to fire him. Lowery had tweeted that the Tea Party was essentially a hysterical grassroots tantrum about the fact that a black guy was president. Baron suggested that Lowery ought to work for an advocacy organization or write an opinion column. Lowery eventually quit, complaining, "Should go without saying. Reporters of color shouldn't have their jobs threatened for speaking out about mainstream media failures to properly cover and contextualize issues of race. What's the point of bringing diverse experiences and voices into a room only to muzzle them?" Lowery ended up at CBS News. Lowery is now widely viewed as the future of mainstream journalism. In June 2020, Ben Smith of the New York Times observed, "Mr. Lowry's view that news organizations' core value needs to be the truth, not the perception of objectivity, as he told me, has been winning in a series of battles, many around how to cover race. The shift in mainstream American media, driven by a journalism that is more personal and reporters more willing to speak what they see as the truth without worrying about alienating conservatives, now feels irreversible." Lowry believes that the American view from nowhere, objectivity-obsessed both-sides journalism is a failed experiment. We need to rebuild our industry as one that operates from a place of moral clarity. Of course, moral clarity is generally a matter of opinion. When you maintain that your opinion is fact and then declare yourself an objective news source rooted in that opinion, you are a liar. And our media are, all too often, liars. The media's woke internal renormalization. The religious wokeness that infuses our newsrooms is enforced daily. It turns out that moral clarity often looks a lot like the Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects it, but at this point, everybody should. The battles in America's newsrooms these days aren't between conservatives and liberals. As we've seen, there are no conservatives at most establishment media outlets. The battle is truly between authoritarian leftists and liberals, between people who may largely agree on policy preferences, but who disagree on whether robust discussion should be allowed. The authoritarian left argues no. The liberals argue yes. Increasingly, the authoritarian leftists are successfully wishing the liberals into the cornfield, or at least intimidating them into dropping any pretense at bipartisanship. The authoritarian left is only tangentially interested in canceling individual conservatives who occasionally write for liberal outlets. Their true goal is to browbeat liberals into preemptively canceling conservatives, thus establishing a total monopoly, assimilating liberals into the woke Borg, or extirpating them. That's what New York Times op-ed editor James Bennett found out the hard way when he had the temerity to greenlight a column from sitting Senator Tom Cotton, Republican of Arkansas. Cotton's column, written in the midst of the BLM riots, suggested that President Trump invoke the Insurrection Act and use the National Guard to quell violence if state and local officials failed to do so. Not only was this a plausible argument, the argument would later be used by those on the left to call for more federal presence in Washington, D.C. following the January 6th riots. But at the time, Cotton's comments were considered not merely foolhardy, but dangerous. Dangerous, as we know, is one of the predicates used by political opponents to stymie dissent. If your words pose a danger to me, they must be banned. That's precisely what New York Times staffers claimed, that because of Cotton's op-ed, they were now under existential threat. This made no sense, given that Times staffers presumably weren't engaged in rioting. But the mere idea that law enforcement ought to crack down on violent activity was enough to send these woke staffers into spasms of apoplexy. Staff writers, including Jenna Wortham, Taffy Brodesser-Ackner, and Kwame Opam, tweeted the same message: "Running this puts black New York Times staff in danger." Reporter Astrid Herndon messaged out support for coworkers, particularly the black ones. Columnist Charlie Warzel tweeted, "I feel compelled to say that I disagree with every word in that Tom Cotton op-ed, and it does not reflect my values." The company's Slack channel blew up with staffers whining over their discomfort. Initially, Bennett defended the move. He tweeted that while many opinion writers and the editorial board had defended the protests and crusaded for years against the underlying systemic cruelties that led to these protests, the newspaper owes it to our readers to show them counterarguments, particularly those made by people in a position to set policy. Within 3 days, Bennett resigned, with publisher A.G. Sulzberger blaming a significant breakdown in our editing process, without noting any actual problems with the cotton piece. Bennett didn't leave without a malice struggle session. He apologized to the staff. The newspaper added an editorial note to the cotton piece, suggesting that it carried a needlessly harsh tone. A bizarre accusation coming from a newspaper that routinely prints the vile, vitriolic, woke word vomit of columnists ranging from Paul Krugman to Charles Blow to Jamelle Bouie. This was a full authoritarian leftist defenestration, revolutionary aggression against the powers that be, top-down censorship, and a sense of moral superiority. Bennett's ouster was merely the latest shot in the ongoing war to oust traditional liberals from positions of power, or to cow them into silence. In March 2018, The Atlantic hired iconoclastic National Review columnist Kevin Williamson. When Jeffrey Goldberg, editor of The Atlantic, hired Williamson, he informed Williamson that he'd stand by him. He even defended Williamson publicly by stating that he would not judge people by their worst tweets or assertions in isolation. That stance lasted just a few days. Goldberg backtracked after staffers told Goldberg they felt threatened by Williamson's pro-life viewpoint, expressed in jocular fashion on a podcast. The language used in the podcast was callous and violent, said Goldberg. I have come to the conclusion that The Atlantic is not the best fit for his talents, and so we are parting ways. Goldberg, the supposed liberal, became yet another tool of the authoritarian left, unwilling to challenge their dominance, even at the risk of editorial self-castration. Something similar happened at Politico when that publication asked me to guest host its prestigious playbook in late December 2020. The publication was, an editor explained, having a series of guest editors, including MSNBC's Chris Hayes, PBS's Yamiche Alcindor, and CNN's Don Lemon, among others. I thought the project might be fun, but as always, I warned the editor that the blowback he received would be immense. My day to write the playbook fell the day after Trump was impeached for the second time in the House of Representatives. I wrote about the generalized Republican unwillingness to vote to impeach and explained that unwillingness by pointing to a belief by most conservatives that impeachment was merely a way of lumping together Trump supporters more broadly with the Capitol rioters. Conservatives correctly saw impeachment as merely the latest club for the left to wield against an opposing political tribe. The blowback was, predictably, immense. Within minutes, Politico was trending on Twitter. Within hours, Politico leadership was hosting a conference call for some 225 staffers enraged over my name, sullying the sacred playbook. Some of those participants compared me to Alex Jones and David Duke, adding that to print my words cut against their journalistic mission, which was to shut me up. I'm spending all this time trying to convince them that we're here for them, that there's a difference between what Ben Shapiro is doing and what Alex Jones is doing and what Politico is doing, one Politico staffer fumed. I don't even know how to go tell them now not to listen to Ben Shapiro because we published Ben Shapiro. 2 weeks later, the staff at Politico was still fuming. More than 100 staffers wrote a letter to the publisher demanding an explanation for why I had been platformed. Most of the establishment media agreed. As Eric Wemple of the Washington Post sneered, you know, if you want to hear Shapiro's opinions, there's a place to go for that. Karen Attia wrote in the Washington Post that platforming me in Politico granted legitimacy to white supremacy and called it willful moral malpractice, adding, I am reminded that in this country, white people once gathered to watch the public lynching of black people and even made souvenir postcards of the events. I am reminded that in America, white racism against minorities is titillating, not disqualifying because it is profitable. Less than 3 months before writing those words, Attia was joking with me on Twitter about grabbing drinks and finding new common ground. She couldn't have proved my point better. Now, this little hubbub had no effect on me. I do have an outlet with extraordinarily high traffic. But the goal of such public shaming rituals is to prevent adventurous editors from even conversing with conservatives. And, as it turns out, that's precisely what happened. I later found out that Guy Benson and Mary Catherine Hamm, both mainstream conservatives who had been asked to guest write the playbook after me, were ghosted by the editors. In effect, they were preemptively canceled. Liberals are being ousted or cowed into submission across the media. The same week, James Bennett resigned. Stan Wichnowski, top editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, stepped down from his position for the great sin of having published an op-ed titled Buildings Matter Too, complaining about BLM rioting and looting. The Inquirer's editors issued a groveling apology, mewling, "We're sorry and regret that we printed it. We also know that an apology on its own is not sufficient." That apology followed staff members calling in sick to protest the editorial and issuing an overwrought letter stating, We're tired of being told of the progress the company has made and being served platitudes about diversity and inclusion when we raise our concerns. We're tired of being told to show both sides of issues there are no two sides of. 1 month later, as the fallout from the BLM purge continued, opinion writer and editor Barry Weiss, a traditional liberal, resigned from the New York Times. Her parting letter was a Molotov cocktail tossed in the middle of the Times editorial structure. Weiss stated that she had been hired to usher in a variety of viewpoints to the Times, but that the newspaper of record had surrendered to the woke. At the Times, Weiss wrote, "Truth isn't a process of collective discovery, but an orthodoxy already known to an enlightened few whose job is to inform everyone else." Calling Twitter the ultimate editor of the paper, she tore into her colleagues, colleagues who had labeled her a Nazi and a racist, and some of whom had publicly smeared her as a bigot. Intellectual curiosity, Weiss wrote, is now a liability at the Times. Nowadays, standing up for principle at the paper does not win plaudits, it puts a target on your back. Weiss concluded, the paper of record is, more and more, the record of those living in a distant galaxy, one whose concerns are profoundly removed from the lives of most people. The newspaper's lack of defense for Weiss stood in stark contrast to its vociferous defense of woke authoritarian leftist thought leader Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. That effort billed itself as a journalistic attempt to recast American history, to view the country as being founded not in 1776, but in 1619, the year of the first importation of an African slave to North American shores. That idea was in and of itself egregiously flawed. America was founded on the principles of the Declaration of Independence. While chattel slavery was a deep, abiding, and evil feature of America during that time and before, as it was unfortunately in a wide variety of countries around the world, it did not provide the core of America's founding philosophy or institutions. But the 1619 Project not only insisted that slavery lay at the center of America's philosophy and that its legacy inextricably wove its way into every American institution, it lied outright in order to press that falsehood forward. The project compiled a series of essays blaming slavery and endemic white supremacy for everything from traffic patterns to corporate use of Excel spreadsheets to track employee time. Then there were the blatant errors, ignored or defended by the Times. Five historians, including Pulitzer Prize winner James McPherson and Bancroft Prize winner Sean Wieland, as well as famed founding-era historian Gordon S. Wood, wrote a letter to the Times blasting the accuracy of the project, including its mischaracterizations of the founding, Abraham Lincoln's views of black equality, and the lack of support for black rights among white Americans. The historians asked that the Times correct the project before its distribution in schools. Hannah-Jones then derisively referred to McPherson's race in order to dismiss the criticism. Jake Silverstein, editor-in-chief of the New York Times Magazine, then acknowledged that we are not ourselves historians, but added that Hannah-Jones was trying to make the point that, for the most part, the history of this country has been told by white historians. Similarly, historian Leslie Harris of Northwestern University wrote that she had warned Hannah-Jones that her contention that the American Revolution was fought in large part to preserve slavery was simply false. Hannah-Jones and the Times ignored her. In the end, after the Times spent millions of dollars to publicize the 1619 Project, the Pulitzer Prize Committee gave the pseudo-history its highest honor. After all, the narrative has been upheld and its critics chided. When the Times printed a piece from its own columnist, Brett Stevens, critical of the 1619 Project in October 2020, the publisher of the newspaper weighed in to call the project a journalistic triumph that changed the way millions of Americans understand our country, its history, and its present, and called the project one of the proudest accomplishments of the Times generally. The New York Times Guild actually attacked Stevens personally, stating that the act, like the article, reeks. Hannah-Jones is currently in a development deal with Oprah Winfrey and Lionsgate to develop the 1619 Project into multiple feature films, TV series, and documentaries. Journalists against free speech. Authoritarian leftists often claim that cancel culture isn't real, that deplatforming isn't a problem because conservatives and traditional liberals can simply present their ideas elsewhere. That argument is the height of gaslighting. It also happens to be utterly specious on its face. It is indeed a cancellation to be barred from participation in the most widely read outlets, thanks to dissent. But consigning conservatives and traditional liberals to non-establishment outlets has a rather unfortunate side effect for the authoritarian leftists. Conservatives and traditional liberals begin consuming non-traditional media at record rates. In the days when the media had a monopoly on the distribution of information, three TV networks, a few national print newspapers, cleansing conservatives would have been the end of the story. But with the rise of the internet, podcasts, and cable news, conservatives have been able to construct media of their own. Websites like the Daily Wire generate enormous traffic because the media have silenced conservative voices. And so the authoritarian leftists must go one step further. They must destroy conservative and traditional liberal voices outside traditional media. They first force those they hate into ideological ghettos. Then, when it turns out the ghettos create their own thriving ecosystems, they seek to level them. To that end, our journalistic new ruling class have become full-scale activists. Instead of reporting on the news, they generate it by working with activist groups to motivate advertisers, neutral service providers, and social media platforms to downgrade or drop dissenting media. They claim that the very presence of conservative ideas in the public square ratchets up the possibility of violence. And then they seek to blame advertisers, neutral service providers, and social media platforms for subsidizing the unwoke or allowing them access to their services. When that fails, they call for outright government regulation of free speech. The founding fathers would have been astonished to learn that the greatest advocates for curbing free speech in the United States are now members of the press. The authoritarian leftist activist journalists pick their targets well. They begin with advertisers. For nearly two decades, Media Matters, a pathetic hit group started by unstable grifter David Brock and backed by Hillary Clinton's team, has spent every waking minute monitoring conservative media for opportunities to push advertiser boycotts. That generally involves cutting conservatives out of context, then letting media allies know about those out-of-context quotes, spinning up controversy, and then creating a fake groundswell of outrage directed at advertisers who generally wish to be left alone. The tactic has been sporadically successful when directed at hosts ranging from Rush Limbaugh to Sean Hannity to Tucker Carlson, and over time, other groups have joined in the game as well. Major media outlets routinely use Media Matters as a source for coverage. An ex-employee of Media Matters bragged in February 2012 that the activist group was pretty much writing MSNBC's prime time and coordinating with the Washington Post's Greg Sargent and reporters from the Los Angeles Times, Huffington Post, and Politico, among others. Media Matters also reportedly held weekly strategy calls with the Obama White House communications director and now Biden chief spokeswoman, Jen Psaki. Members of the media don't merely crib off of Media Matters' out-of-context clips. They then target advertisers, asking them why they are continuing to spend their dollars with conservatives. Naturally, such questions aren't designed to elicit a response. They're designed to elicit a cancellation of the advertising dollars. And the media cheer when they start an advertiser cancellation cascade against a conservative. Their glee is fully evident. Members of the establishment media cheer on this tactic. In fact, they go further. They call for anyone who provides services to the unwoke to stop doing so. They call for Comcast to stop carrying Newsmax, One America News, and Fox News. Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times recently wrote that in order to dampen the extremism of the Republican Party, advertisers should stop supporting networks that spread lies and hatred, and cable companies should drop channels that persist in doing so. As a start, don't force people to subsidize Fox News by including it in basic packages. Sure, Kristof acknowledged this could create a slippery slope, but the slippery slope was a lesser risk than Kristof's opponents being able to make a living. Margaret Sullivan of the Washington Post agreed, calling Fox News a hazard to our democracy and demanding that corporations that advertise on Fox News should walk away and citizens who care about the truth should demand that they do so. Max Boot of the Washington Post believes that large cable companies need to step in and kick Fox News off. CNN's Oliver Darcy joined the chorus, stating that TV companies that provide platforms to networks like Fox News ought not escape scrutiny. It is time TV carriers face questions for lending their platforms to dishonest companies that profit off of disinformation and conspiracy theories. Darcy even called up cable platforms to attempt to pressure them. This stuff is fully delusional. Were conservatives to be deprived of Fox News, they'd seek a similar conservative outlet. But that delusion is consistent with the authoritarian left's true goal, a reestablishment of the media monopoly it had before the death of the Fairness Doctrine and the rise of Rush Limbaugh. Many on the authoritarian left celebrated when Limbaugh died, declaring him polarizing. The reality is that they were polarizing, but they had a monopoly. And Limbaugh broke that monopoly. Now they want to reestablish it at all costs. This is why the media grow particularly vengeful when it comes to distribution of conservative ideas via social media. A shocking number of media members spend their days seeking to pressure social media platforms into curbing free speech standards in order to reinstitute an establishment media monopoly. Now, blaming social media platforms for violence is sort of like blaming free speech for Nazis. Yes, bad people can take advantage of neutral platforms to do bad things. That doesn't mean the platforms should be restricted. But for pseudo-journalists like Joe Scarborough of MSNBC, the platforms bear primary responsibility for violence. Those riots would not have happened but for Twitter, but for Facebook. Facebook's algorithms were set up to cause this sort of radicalism to explode. By citing the danger of free speech, our establishment media can close the pathways of informational dissemination to those outside the new ruling class. These media members consider anyone outside their own worldview an enemy worth banning. Mainstream media members simply lump in mainstream conservatives with violent radicals, and voila, it's time for social media to step in and get rid of them. Kara Swisher of the New York Times spends her column space day after day attempting to pressure Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook to set restrictive content regulations in violation of free speech principles. "Mr. Zuckerberg," Swisher wrote in 2020, "has become, unwittingly or not, the digital equivalent of a supercharged enabler because of his enormous power over digital communications that affects billions of people." And, Swisher added, "Zuckerberg shouldn't worry about free speech as a value. After all, the First Amendment doesn't mention Facebook or any other company, and there's no mention of Mark Zuckerberg, who certainly has the power to rein in a speech that violates company rules. Free speech is the problem. Corporate censorship is the solution." And what sort of content should be restricted? The tech reporters believe the answer is obvious: anything right of center. That's why, day after day, Kevin Roos of the New York Times tweets out organic reach of conservative sites, trying to pressure Facebook into changing its algorithm. It's why the New York Times ran a piece by Roos in June 2019 titled "The Making of a YouTube Radical," linking everyone from Jordan Peterson, Joe Rogan, and me to Alex Jones and Jared Taylor. Roos lamented, "YouTube has inadvertently created a dangerous on-ramp to extremism." The goal is obvious: get everyone right of center deplatformed and threaten the platforms themselves in order to do so. It won't stop there. Media members have now decided in the post-Trump age that it's time to rewrite the First Amendment bargain altogether. Jim VandeHei of Politico acknowledges that Blue America hopes desperately to rethink politics, free speech, the definition of truth, and the price of lies. The First Amendment must be rethought. In 2019, Richard Stengel, now the head of Joe Biden's transition team for the U.S. Agency for Global Media, contended that America ought to embrace hate speech laws, since free speech should not protect hateful speech that can cause violence by one group against another. New York University journalism professor and MSNBC contributor Anand Jardhardas questions, should Fox News be allowed to exist? Steve Cole, dean of Columbia Journalism School, now believes that those in journalism have come to terms with the fact that free speech, a principle we hold sacred, is being weaponized against the principles of journalism. Bill Adair, founder of the highly biased news fact-checking source PolitiFact, now believes that the government should use regulations and new laws to fight the problems of misinformation. Curbing free speech has two particular benefits for the establishment media. First, it boosts their competitors. Second, it purges the public sphere of views they dislike. It's a win-win. All they require is ideologically authoritarian control. Conclusion. On January 18th, 2019, during the March for Life, something frightening happened. A group of high school boys wearing MAGA hats swarmed around an innocent Native American man, taunting him, laughing and dancing. Reports suggested that four Black protesters had also been harassed by the cruel white students. The Native American man told the media that he had confronted the students while they shouted, "Build the wall." And the journalistic world went to work journalisming as hard as they could. Kara Swisher tweeted, "Those awful kids and their fetid, smirking, harassing that elderly man on the mall. Go F yourselves." Joe Scarborough tweeted, "Where are their parents? Where are their teachers? Where are their pastors?" The New York Times headlined, "Boys in Make America Great Again hats mob Native elder at Indigenous People's March." CNN called the incident a heartbreaking viral video. There was only one problem. It wasn't true. In reality, as Covington Catholic student Nick Sandman, the kid in the MAGA hat, stated, the white students were accosted by four Black members of the Black Hebrew Israelites, a radical group of nutcases who had called them racists, bigots, F-words, and incest kids. The students were also accosted by the Native American man, who strode into their group and began banging a drum in their faces. Sandman stood still, smiling awkwardly. As Sandman related, "I was not intentionally making faces at the protester. I did smile at one point because I wanted him to know that I was not going to become angry, intimidated, or be provoked into a larger confrontation. I'm a faithful Christian and practicing Catholic, and I always try to live up to the ideals my faith teaches me, to remain respectful of others, and to take no action that would lead to conflict or violence." Sandman was telling the truth. Nearly every element of the story, as reported by the establishment media, was false. "The elite media have botched the story so completely that they have lost the authority to report on it," wrote Caitlin Flanagan of The Atlantic. Flanagan went further, slamming the New York Times. "You were partly responsible for the election of Trump because you are the most influential newspaper in the country and you are not fair or impartial. Millions of Americans believe you hate them and that you will casually harm them." Nothing has changed. If anything, the problem has grown worse. The establishment media have declared themselves the heroes of the past 4 years, the bravest, the most noble, the guardians of our democracy. They weren't, and they aren't. They are willing to attack everyone from commoners to kings to advance their agenda. Doubt them, and they'll cast you out. Compete with them, and they'll work to silence you. Within days of Joe Biden's ascension to the White House, our journalisming experts reverted from watchdogs to lapdogs. CNN's Dana Bash-Spoon, the adults are back in the room. CNN's White House reporter Jim Acosta tweeted a picture of himself with NBC News' Peter Alexander. Just a couple of guys covering the White House on the last full day of Trump admin. Think we will finally have time for that drink now, Peter Alexander? CNN's Brian Stelter, host of the ironically named Reliable Sources, wrote a glowing chyron about White House press secretary and former CNN contributor Jen Psaki's assurance that she would only speak truth. Psaki promises to share accurate info. How refreshing. Margaret Sullivan of the Washington Post praised the Biden White House's return to normalcy and warned against media members being too harsh on the new administration. It's all fine. Trust them. This is dangerous stuff. It's dangerous that the guardians of our democracy, the media, aren't guardians, but political activists dedicated to their own brand of propaganda. It's even more dangerous that they now work on an ongoing basis to stymie voices with whom they disagree and use the power of their platforms to destroy their opponents at every level. A thriving marketplace of ideas requires a basic respect for the marketplace itself. But our ideologically driven, authoritarian leftist media seek to destroy that marketplace in favor of a monopoly. Every day, they come closer to achieving that goal. Chapter 8, Unfriending Americans. 1 month before the 2020 election, the New York Post released a bombshell report, a report that could have upended the nature of the election. That report centered on Hunter Biden, son of Joe Biden, the Democratic presidential nominee. According to the Post report, Hunter Biden introduced his father, then Vice President Joe Biden, to a top executive at a Ukrainian energy firm less than a year before the elder Biden pressured government officials in Ukraine into firing a prosecutor who was investigating the company, according to emails obtained by the Post. A board member of Burisma, the company on whose board Hunter Biden sat, sent Hunter Biden a note of appreciation to thank him for the introduction. The bombshell rebutted Joe Biden's consistent statements that he knew nothing about his son's business activities abroad and that Hunter's activities had all been above board. The Post even reported the provenance of the emails. Hunter Biden's laptop had been dropped off at a computer repair shop in Delaware in 2019, and Hunter had never returned to pick up that computer. The Post further reported that both the computer and hard drive were seized by the FBI in December after the shop's owner says he alerted the feds to their existence.